You've tuned in a special Memorial Day edition of All Together Now. We have some news updates, and then we're going to hear Amy Goodman speak at Sanctuary for Independent Media on May 21st. Simulcast on WGXC. You can hear the rest in the archives at WGXC.org. A special Memorial Day edition of All Together Now.
Interrupt this broadcast to bring you a special news bulletin.
Stay tuned to this station.
Stand by for news.
Direct via satellite from our on-the-spot task force.
Good evening from our newsroom in New York.
This is
Daily News and Weather Report.
We take you now to
this radio broadcast.
You are tuned in to All Together Now, a collaborative one-hour news show for community radio stations in the Capital Region and New York's Hudson Valley. All Together Now features contributions from the public, along with programmers at WOOC in Troy and WGXC in Accra, featuring local and regional news, weather updates, and newsmaker interviews.
Daily Freeman reports that the following public spaces are closed or have altered services for Monday, May 30th, Memorial Day. Amtrak runs on a holiday schedule. The banks are closed. County offices are closed. Columbia County Solid Waste is closed. Federal offices are closed. Financial markets are closed. Greene County Transit has no service. There is no mail delivery. Metro North is on a Sunday schedule. The schools are closed. State offices are closed. And Trailways is on a holiday schedule. There are parades in Tannersville on Sunday and on Monday in Ghent, in Philmont, in Germantown, in Greenville, in Hudson, in Hillsdale, and Hunter, and Chatham, and Cairo, and Kinderhook, and Prattsville, and Coxsackie, and Catskill. And details are all at the newsroom at WGXC.org. Greg Hudson in the Daily Mail reports that Greenville is the latest town to reconsider its commercial solar regulations after state rules have companies looking to set up solar farms throughout the area. Cairo, Coxsackie, Jefferson, Saugerties, and many other towns have held public hearings recently over new rules for commercial solar installations, and Greenville is the latest, with a 6:30 p.m. June 20th hearing at the Greenville Town Hall. Greenville Town Supervisor Paul Macko said, quote, "This is much larger scale than what people are allowed to put on their roofs. Companies want to have access to 5, 10, 15, sometimes 20 acres of land to lease for solar harvesting," unquote. Read the full story in the Daily Mail. Philip Grant has this report.
The March for Farm Worker Justice left Smithtown on Long Island on May 15th, heading to Albany with stops in Saugerties, Catskill, and Ravenna May 29th, 30th, and 31st. Marchers are attempting to bring attention to the need for legislative action to end the inequality that currently burdens farm workers in the state. The New York Civil Liberties Union filed suit on May the 10th against the state and Governor Andrew Cuomo over the state not allowing farm workers to organize. The group marches to Albany for Farm Worker Albany Day on Wednesday, June the 1st.
Next, the national headlines from Public News Service.
Governor Andrew Cuomo has introduced a package of bills to close a major loophole in New York State's campaign finance laws. The LLC loophole allows individuals to form multiple limited liability companies and use each one to give a candidate more than $60,000 in each election cycle. Jessica Wisniewski with Citizen Action of New York calls the governor's introduction of bills to finally close that loophole a really bold move.
He's willing to do it himself. He thinks it should be done for everyone. And now it's in the hands of the Senate Republican majority to let us know, as voters, whose side they're on.
Legislation to close the LLC loophole has passed the State Assembly several times, but has not yet made it through the Senate. Republican Senate Majority Leader John Flanagan called the governor's move a red herring that fails to address deeper problems, but Wisniewski notes that despite major corruption scandals, reform legislation has been slow in coming.
If the political will is only there for closing the LLC loophole this year, that would be a tremendously significant reform.
This month, the former leaders of both the Assembly and the Senate were sentenced to long prison terms on corruption charges. Ethics reform is high on the agenda of most New York voters, and closing the LLC loophole has long been at the top of the list. Wisniewski thinks legislators should be nervous about heading into elections this fall, having done nothing to clean up their act.
So I hope to see something done. If not, I think this will become a major election issue between now and November.
The current legislative session ends in just 3 weeks. For New York News Connection, I'm Andrea Sears.
Alana Medlock has this report.
New York's Department of Transportation did not shut down Route 9H on May 25th, and instead Route 9H and Route 23 between U.S. Route 9 and Orchard Road will be closed beginning at 9 a.m. Tuesday, May 31st. Traffic will be directed to follow a posted detour. The road will be closed for construction until approximately November 11th, 2016.
Today we listened to Amy Goodman speak May 21st at the Sanctuary for Independent Media, the host of Democracy Now! That airs every morning on WGXC at 8 a.m., spoke as the Sanctuary for Independent Media in Troy got its news station WOOC-LP on the air.
Thank you very, very much. Well, it's really wonderful to be here with all of you. I'm just wondering if people at the back, could they maybe sit on the stage or something? I hate for you to have to stand. Is that allowed?
Yeah.
Yes. How about anyone who wants to sit right here? That would be great.
Come on up and sit on the stage or file on back to the back room. There is a free...
Oh, it's very cool back there. That's the best place to be. Two seats here, two seats here, two seats here, two seats here. That's eight seats. See, there's two there, three there, two there, and there are nice, cool, air-conditioned seats in the back. Oh, my gosh, thank you so much. These are beautiful. Oh, my gosh. Yes. Well, thank you very much for that question. It's a good place to start. We still have another seat here, and we have plenty of seats here. You can even sit on the piano bench. But it would be nice if you guys sat down. If anyone feels comfortable sitting on the ground, there's some nice seats here. Well, to be back in the Sanctuary for Independent Media. What a wonderful space this is. And to be here on the 10th anniversary and to see it expanding inside and out to the collard greens, gardens, to the community space that was just bought across the way. That will be a science center and an art space. The Sanctuary for Independent Media is transforming Troy, and you are all a part of that. This is what it takes, community by community. And it really did, as Steve Pierce, by the way, Steve and Branda, Elizabeth Press, who's behind the camera as usual, and all the folks who have made this sanctuary happen for these last 10 years deserve a tremendous round of applause. I'm sure Branda Miller is just working behind the scenes, and that's why this place is what it is today and will be what it is tomorrow as they hand over the reins to community, to people coming in future generations. You're all making this happen. And as Steve was taking me around outside, I couldn't help but think about Detroit, the kind of self-sufficiency, people taking sustainability into their own hands. Just down the road from Detroit, of course, is Flint. And If you're... Sorry, this is what a 100-city tour sounds like. I'll tell you a funny story. First, I have to figure out this. Interesting. I should say, before I talk about Flint, Michigan, let me talk a little about this tour. So Democracy Now! Is celebrating 20 years. And so I know... And we're really excited about this, and many of you have been a part of it from the beginning. And some of you have come midway through, and maybe some of you were brought by a friend tonight and really know not much about it. And all of that thrills me. The idea that someone will discover Democracy Now! Anew, or that you've been here for 20 years. So we've been traveling the country on this 100-city tour, celebrating independent media all over. This morning, I was in Toronto, Canada. Last night, we were in Toronto celebrating CIUT, which is the largest community radio station. It's at the University of Toronto. In the days before that, we were in Chicago, we were in Minneapolis, we were in Bar Harbor, Maine, and Bangor, and in Portland, Maine. But we were celebrating KMUD up in Northern California a week or two ago. And KMUD, the event we had was in a place called Redway. It's a different country up there. Now, we are also throughout Colorado, you know, where cannabis is legal, where pot is legal. And then we moved to Northern California, where it's not exactly legal, but it is accepted as about 90% of the economy. I mean, I've never seen anything like it. At the reception before, you know, you ask people, what do you do? Well, I'm a businessman in town. Oh, what do you sell? Pot. And, you know, he didn't whisper it. He said it. Ask someone, oh, what do you do here? I'm a manicurist. Oh, at a local salon? Looks at me. I clip buds. So then I was speaking that night, and as usual, I started to cough. And let me answer the question of this, or someone is going to be spending their evening looking for something they don't need to look for. So that evening, and then I turn this off. So that evening, I was giving the talk, and I started to cough, and my lozenge of choice is Ricola. So people were throwing up Ricolas, and so I opened one, but it didn't look anything like Ricola. So anyway, if someone would like to taste test this, because I really would like to have a sip of it. Anyway, no. But it's been a very interesting journey. I was also I was racing to San Francisco Airport. Now, I've been doing this journey with my colleagues at Democracy Now! A producer a week joins us. I just left Mike Burke, I think yesterday morning, our senior producer who did Chicago and Canada with us. And the week before, it was Laura Gottesdiener, and we had done Flint together before that. She's the newest member of our producing team. Amy Littlefield was the week before that. And my colleagues who wrote the book with me, Democracy Now!, Dennis Moynihan, who I call the Johnny Appleseed of community media in this country. He's helping to build a full-power FM station in Colorado and a low-power one in Denver, and is really was seminal with Angie Caron, who I was just with at the big PBS conference in Chicago this week, in growing Democracy Now! From 9 stations 20 years ago in 1996 to over 1,400 stations today. We started on community radio and Pacifica stations, and then we expanded to television the week of September 11th. We were on as emergency broadcasting, the closest national broadcast to Ground Zero, the horror that took place, September 11th. And then once we went on TV, very quickly other TV stations said, how can we get this show? And we started FedExing out the video cassettes. That was what we used at the time. And I wanted it to be FedEx because I thought it was breaking news. It couldn't be more than a day late. And then the NPR station in a town would say, oh, that we have on the television station, can we run it? And now PBS stations all over the country are running Democracy Now. And we're broadcasting around the world, many times a day in Sweden, on television and radio in Japan. They call it the other America. In South Africa, throughout Latin America, our headlines are translated into Spanish. And if you're trying to learn Spanish or English, you can go on our website and you have the English headlines, the Spanish headlines, the same thing translated, as well as the audio of both. So if you want to listen and learn, we work with an Uruguayan collective. And this has just been a remarkable experience. But we were, so my colleagues, Dennis Moynihan, who is also the person I write a column with every week, and my brother, journalist David Goodman, co-authored this book. Or I should say, if they weren't there, this book would never have been written. But it talks about the 20 years of covering the movements changing America. And it's called Democracy Now! And we were racing to San Francisco Airport. We've raced there about three times in the last 4 weeks. And I knew Dennis's birthday was in the last few weeks, and I decided what to get him. He was the tour guide extraordinaire. He's the one who designed this trip. I think I'm going to get him a map. But on one of these trips to San Francisco Airport, we got a call from AJ Plus. It's Al Jazeera Plus, Al Jazeera Online. Sadly, Al Jazeera America has folded. I hope Al Jazeera doesn't follow suit. But AJ Plus is very successful. And they said, can you come to our offices in San Francisco? We'd like to interview you about the elections. And I said, oh, we're racing to the airport. Sorry, I can't do it. No, just a few minutes, please. So I said, I mean, really, 3 minutes? Are you on the way to the airport? Yes, we are. Okay, so we stopped in for 3 minutes. Dennis hadn't even gotten out of the car before I ran out. Sat down, did the interview, said hi to everyone. The place is half empty. It was the Current Network's offices. Remember, Al Gore had Current TV. And so I saw his offices, you know, the vice president. And he sold it to Al Jazeera for $500 million. And now Al Jazeera has gone under. But they then put this AJ Plus 3-minute video online like, 10 days ago. And I haven't checked in the last few days, but like a week ago, maybe 6 days after it was up, it had 11.7 million views. I mean, it went viral, and I don't think it's any different than what any of you would say about these elections. It just doesn't hit the corporate media radar screen. It is so important that we have a media that gives voice to, well, the full diversity of voices. That's mainly what I was talking about. I mean, you look at all the networks. I was also invited on CNN a couple times to critique the media. And I said, you know, I can't tell the difference between CNN, MSNBC, and Fox. You couldn't even single out one of them. Because Donald Trump sounds the same on all three networks. And especially with that lower third, breaking news, every time he has something to say. I was just in Toronto yesterday. And I turn on the television, and it's the horror of the plane that went down between Paris and Cairo. And, you know, they're talking about, you know, the agony, and loved ones are talking about their loved ones. And in the upper right corner, Donald Trump is about to speak. So they're just showing the screen of the podium. He's about to address the NRA. And they're waiting. And this is for over an hour. They've got that little screen and they're just waiting, and it's breaking news, Donald Trump to speak. So Look at the Tyndall report and the coverage of the elections in 2015. Donald Trump got 23 times the coverage of Bernie Sanders. I think it was on ABC World News Tonight gave Donald Trump 81 minutes, Bernie Sanders 20 seconds. I'd like to know what Bernie Sanders did that was so newsworthy that he should have gotten that 20 seconds. Let's look at one night of primaries, March 15th. That was Super Tuesday 3. That was Missouri, Illinois, North Carolina, Ohio, and Florida. Okay? So that was the night that Marco Rubio lost his home state, Florida. You remember Senator Rubio? Yeah. And so he gave his concession speech. All the networks played it, as they should, and he pulled out. And that was the night that Ohio Governor John Kasich gave his victory speech because he had his first primary victory, his home state of Ohio. Remember Governor Kasich? Yes. So, and they played his speech. Then Ted Cruz spoke. Hillary Clinton spoke. She had just won Ohio and Florida and North Carolina. It was very smart to speak then because Missouri and Illinois were too close to call. Better to speak while you're ahead. And Illinois was significant because it was her home state. And they were saying, all the networks were saying, Sanders, Clinton, too close to call, it's going to go through the night. Then they were waiting for Donald Trump, and they showed the empty podium in one of his Florida mansions, and they kept waiting and waiting, and the pundits and all the networks, you know, they're showing this empty little square, are all the pundits, you know, who know so little about so much, explaining the world to us and getting it so wrong. Filling the airtime. And finally, after about half an hour, he speaks, and he speaks for about half an hour. You know, he's pioneered this idea, calls it a news conference. So everyone calls it a news conference. It's not a news conference. But a few weeks before that, he'd held that hour news conference after another primary so-called news conference where he's trumpeting Trump water, Trump steaks, Trump magazines. It was this kind of bizarre. And the network stayed with it the entire hour. Hillary Clinton spoke within that time. They did not cut away to her, right? They did not cut away. They recorded her, though, and they played her after. So, okay, so this night, March 15th, Super Tuesday 3. So I said they played Trump, they played Kasich, Cruz, Clinton, and Rubio. So that would pretty much wrap it up, right? I mean, there's no one else that's running. Oh, wait, I saw some buttons here. Bernie who? Oh, Bernie Sanders. I mean, it is absolutely amazing. I mean, did he, you know, fall asleep? Where was he? I mean, falling asleep, that would make Arianna Huffington very happy because, you know, she just wrote The Sleep Revolution. I actually was on Bill Maher with her a few weeks ago, and so I saw her backstage and Susan Sarandon, and I wanted to challenge Arianna to a duel, a kind of debate. Around the merits of sleeplessness, but she would not have anything of it. And I did promise her I would take a long nap in June. But anyway, did Bernie Sanders fall asleep? Did he take the night off? What was he doing? They weren't even, not only didn't they play his speech, if he had given one, they didn't even speculate where the guy was. So, we also, in this 100-city tour, did a swing through Arizona, Flagstaff, Tucson, Phoenix. So I know this for a fact because I spoke to many people who were at his rally March 15th in the evening. Thousands and thousands and thousands and thousands and thousands and thousands of people. He gave a speech before by far the largest audience that night. But they didn't play it. They didn't even refer to it. They didn't even ask where he was. There is something worse than negative coverage. It's the vanishing. So we made a decision that night on Democracy Now! That the next day in the morning when we broadcast Democracy Now!, we'd play an excerpt of Bernie Sanders' speech. Who would have thunk it? Who would have thought it is a revolutionary act to play an excerpt of a speech of a major party candidate on a major primary night or the morning after? But that is what it has become. I mean, this is a person, whether you're for him or against him, who has broken so many records, right? Look at March. I think he raised $44 million to Hillary Clinton's $29 million. He raises it with three, seven, nine. I think the average is $27 contribution. So no one's maxing out. They can keep on giving. Hillary Clinton, and he has like well over 6 million donors. I mean, he's breaking all records. And Hillary Clinton has far fewer donors, but they give a lot more, and a lot of them are maxing out. He raises money on the campaign trail and his rallies. She has to go off the campaign trail and go behind closed doors to raise this money. So we were just passing through Laurel Canyon, California. We were not at the same place she was. She was having a fundraiser at George and Amal Clooney's house. I think the going rate for a seat at the head table was $350,000. $350,000. I mean, that was for a couple, but... And George Clooney was even asked on the networks, you know, what about this? And even he said it was obscene, and he threw the party. Now, where is this money going to? And it's not just Hillary Clinton. This massive amount of money these candidates raise, it's not going to build community gardens, right? The vast majority of it is going to the television networks. And so do you really think they're going to raise this as an issue? You know, they're paying for campaign advertising. So you had a few weeks ago, and some of you might have been a part of this, 1,200 people arrested in Washington, D.C., part of Democracy Spring and Democracy Awakening, challenging the corrupting influence of money in politics. They hardly, you know, following in the footsteps of Granny D, they hardly got coverage in the major networks. I mean, as they're being dragged away, they're shouting, where's CNN? Where's MSNBC? Could you imagine if there was a protest in central Havana, Cuba, where 1,200 people were arrested? You have all the network news anchors flying down. Now they can do it direct, right? Flying down to Havana to cover, you know, this act of repression, right? This 1,200 people arrested. And they would have paid attention at least. But they weren't paying attention to this. Or were they paying attention and deciding not to run? What it was that was happening, because they are the beneficiaries of this corrupt system and this corrupting system that is drowning politics in money in this country and vested interests. Now, these are the issues that must be raised, and this is why we need independent media. That's not brought to you by the politicians. That's not brought to you by the weapons industry when we cover War and Peace. That's not brought to you by the insurance industry or Big Pharma when we cover healthcare. That's not brought to you by the oil, the gas, the coal companies, the nuclear companies when we cover climate change. But it's brought to you by listeners and viewers. And people like you and not like you who are deeply committed to independent media. And when the family of independent media grows, it's a cause for celebration for all of us. Why it's so wonderful that right behind the stage, right here at the Sanctuary for Independent Media, is the new low-power FM station, WOOC. And I hope you all get involved with your own... with your own community radio station right in Troy. I mean, every one of these stations is part of that huge kitchen table that stretches across the globe, that we all sit around and debate and discuss the most important issues of the day. War and peace, life and death, and anything less than that is a disservice to the servicemen and women of this country. They can't have these debates on military bases. They rely on us and civilian society to have the discussions that lead to the decisions about whether they live or die, whether they are sent to kill or be killed. Anything less than that is a disservice to a democratic society. So On this 100 City Tour, we're celebrating the media that has been broadcasting Democracy Now!, sometimes from the beginning. Like, oh, the first day we're in Ithaca College, we were on April 6th. And then on April 8th, we were at The Ohio State University. They've added the recently. In Columbus, The Ohio State University. On April 9th, in the morning, we started in St. Louis, and then in the afternoon, we're in Columbia, Missouri, where Mizzou is, the site of an amazing uprising of students. A young student named Jonathan Butler, African-American student, went on a hunger strike. Black Lives Matter activist students at University of Missouri at Mizzou joined him. And then, amazingly, the black athletes, the black football players, joined in solidarity, and that was it, because football is the fulcrum of power. There. Just one sec. Don't throw anything up. I don't know. I'll take care of it. So, after the black students tweeted out a picture of... No. Okay, thank you. Thank you. Does anyone want to try this first? Does anyone know that man? It's good. After the black football players tweeted out a picture of themselves in solidarity, tweeted out this message, then the white football players and their coach joined them in support. So the coach. Now, what Jonathan Butler was calling for is the resignation of the president of the university. He felt that so many racist incidents had happened that hadn't been dealt with properly. When the white coach joined, well, then it was over. The coach makes 8 times more than the president at the university. The students, these athletes, said they weren't going to play ball, and that's a huge deal. Every game at the University of Missouri, the football players refused to play. The university lost $1 million to the chancellor, so the president left, or said he was leaving. We went on that night to Kansas City, to KKFI, and it was getting scary because by then we were like an hour and a half late. This was 3 days into the tour. A man was weaving on the highway, and I was calling the police because it was clearly going to be an accident, seriously weaving. I don't often call the police, but there was going to be an accident, called, said, come quickly, that there's going to be something terrible happening on this highway, and... no one came, and it was 15 minutes, called again, but now I was in a new precinct, and they said, oh, a lot of people are calling, and as I was on the phone, he just smashed into the side of the road, and then we all raced into the woods. There was this black motorcycle gang of men and women, and they all, us and them, all, they threw their motorcycles into the ground, and we were going through the bramble to find this white SUV, older gentleman who was just disoriented, but he was actually okay. So we then started to make our way again on the highway to Kansas City, and in front of us was this big tractor-trailer truck, and just as we get on the highway, his tire blew. So I said, what next? Like, we're going to drive into Tornado Alley? So by the time we got to KKFI to celebrate, it was an hour and a half late, and I was saying, my God, we have 100 cities, or at that point, 96 cities to go. And the 95th city, we're going to be like months late. But KKFI is an interesting place, Kansas City. Dennis Moynihan, co-author of this book, years ago worked on the Leonard Peltier Defense Committee. And he was at Leavenworth. He's now in Florida, Peltier in prison in Florida. And at the time, he was appealing for clemency from President Clinton. And he used to call into the office every morning at 8 or 9. And he would say, and he wouldn't call before that, because he said he and the brothers would be in the recreation yard sitting around a tiny transistor radio because the warden had required it be smaller and smaller. And these big guys would surround it to listen to Democracy Now! And then he wanted to talk about everything he heard, and he said that the prisoners would talk all day about what they heard. We then were in Atlanta, Georgia, celebrating WRFG, Radio Free Georgia. They had recently gotten a contribution of $325 in their pledge drive, nice size. It was from 65 prisoners, each $5, at the maximum security prison nearby, thanking them for Democracy Now! And other programs. And then just before we left on this 100-city tour, we got an email from a prison administrator in England. About a year ago, he asked if he could run Democracy Now! On prison closed-circuit TV. And we said, of course. We've pioneered this way of sending broadcast-quality video through the Internet. So they've been running it for a year. And just before we left, he sent an email and said, we attribute a 50% increase in prisoners enrolling in classes to Democracy Now! They are just so... so hungry for information. You know, information from people who are in their communities. It's not the know-nothing pundits. It is people who are deeply involved in the issues. And I think the reason these are difficult issues, why it isn't depressing or hopeless, which I feared it would be that people would feel that way, is that you're hearing about these issues from people who are doing something about it. And that gives us the greatest hope. So we also, just 2 weeks ago, were celebrating KPFA, the First Pacifica Station, on its 67th birthday. That's right, KPFA went on the air in 1949. That was the first station of Pacifica. It was founded by a man named Lou Hill, who was a war resister, a conscientious objector. And when he came out of the detention camps out of World War II, he said, there has to be a media outlet that's not run by corporations that profit from war. That's run by journalists and artists. That's how Pacifica was born. As George Gerbner, the late dean of the Annenberg School of Communications at the University of Pennsylvania, would say, not run by corporations that have nothing to tell and everything to sell, that are raising our children today. And so KPFA was born, 1949. KPFK went on the air 10 years later in Los Angeles. We were just there celebrating KPFK, 1959. As I was going up on the stage to celebrate KPFK, I get a text. Juan Carlos and Charina have been arrested. Okay. Juan Carlos Davila is our fellow, video fellow. He hails from the University of California, Santa Cruz. He discovered Democracy Now! Years ago as a Puerto Rican student activist in Puerto Rico. Also, Charina Nadura. Charina went to Brooklyn College. She then was an intern of Democracy Now! She went on to work for Bill Moyers until he wrapped up his program and came back to us as a videographer, and she is a video producer now. So that night a few weeks ago in New York City was a Trump rally of 1,000 people, and Charina and Juan Carlos went out to cover it. Routine. Except that they were on this little, I didn't even know there was a bridge there, but bridge next to Grand Central Station. They had this bird's eye. Then the police moved up to the protesters and they started arresting people, and then they moved in on Charina and Juan Carlos. And there was a commanding officer there. He said, let them film. They have a right to film. But then he went away. And these guys moved in on them. They pushed Juan Carlos's face into the dirt. They confiscated their equipment, and they arrested them. They put them in a police van, that's what I was told, and they said they handcuffed them. So I'm about to go up on the stage, just like today. I'm like, oh, my God. Well, I have to go. Who am I going to talk to? So I texted Juan Carlos, and I said, are you okay? I didn't exactly expect to get anything back, and then I got back a yes. Have you been arrested? Yes. Are you in a police van? Yes. Are you handcuffed? Yes. Are you handcuffed with your hands behind your back? Yes. But nothing he wrote. Everything was perfectly written. And I said, so how are you texting? And he said, yes. So I called Juan Gonzalez, and both of us were calling the police. And Sam Alkoff, our video producer, raced to Police Plaza to try to get them out. And finally, after many hours, got them out. We now have to deal with their arrests. But that night, if you think they just went home, think again. Juan Carlos and Sharina and Sam raced back to the newsroom, and they produced the video piece that you would see the next morning on Democracy Now about the mass protests, the people who were arrested, including themselves, including Juan Carlos and Sharina. We as reporters shouldn't have to get a record when we put things on the record. It's just unacceptable. So KPFK went on the air in 1959, WBAI, our station in New York, 1960. Within a year, it's broadcasting a debate between Malcolm X and James Baldwin, the great writer over the effectiveness of nonviolent civil disobedience. They were debating the effectiveness of the lunch counter sit-ins in the South. KPFT in Houston went on the air in 1970, WPFW in Washington, 77. And that's the Fab Five. That's the Pacifica Radio Network. KPFT in Houston is the only radio station that was blown up in the United States. Right, it goes on the air in the spring of 1970. The Ku Klux Klan straps dynamite to the base of the transmitter and blows it to smithereens. right in the middle of Arlo Guthrie singing Alice's Restaurant. And I thought that was a good song. But anyway, so... after a few weeks, you know, they get back on their feet. I mean, there is a silver lining. It's not like Pacific had money for advertising. It certainly blew it into the consciousness of the potential listening audience of the people of the Petro Metro. I don't recommend this as an advertising strategy, but they went back on the air. And then the Klan blew them up again, this time with 15 times the dynamite strapped to the base of the transmitter. So now it's going to take months for them to get back on their feet. And in January 1971, PBS comes in to broadcast this moment when the phoenix rises from the ashes. Arlo Guthrie comes to Houston to finish his song live on the air, Alice's Restaurant. And KPFT goes back on the air. Now, I can't remember if it was the Exalted Cyclops or the Grand Dragon, because I often confuse their titles, but... he said it was his proudest act. I think that's because he understood how dangerous Pacific is, how dangerous independent media is. Dangerous because it allows people to speak for themselves. And when you hear someone speaking from their own experience, whether it's a Palestinian child or an Israeli grandmother, whether it is an aunt in Iraq or an uncle in Afghanistan, whether it's a kid from the South Bronx or from the South Valley in Albuquerque, where we just were speaking at RFK High School, where the overwhelming majority of the students are undocumented. When you hear someone speaking from their own experience, it challenges the stereotypes and the caricatures that fuel the hate groups. You say, it sounds like my bubba, my baby, my aunt, my uncle. And I'm not saying you'll agree with them. How often do we agree with our family members? But you begin to understand where they're coming from. That understanding is the beginning of peace. It makes it much less likely that you'll want to destroy them. That understanding is the beginning of peace. I think the media can be... I think the media can be the greatest force for peace on earth. Instead, all too often, it's wielded as a weapon of war. Now, I can't talk about Democracy Now! Without talking about my co-host on Democracy Now! For the full 20 years. He is Juan Gonzalez. Now, We just had the great honor. Well, a few weeks ago, he retired from the New York Daily News after 29 years as a columnist. He wasn't always a journalist. I mean, he was a kid, and then he grew up. And then he was one of the founders of the Young Lords, sort of the Puerto Rican equivalent of the Black Panthers. And, you know, they would hijack tuberculosis vans in New York City, and you never had more willing hostage drivers. You know, they would hijack them to the South Bronx, to places where they needed to be, and the drivers got into the business because they wanted to help people, too. They would occupy churches because they want kids to have hot lunches. And then Juan decided to serve the community in a different way, through his journalism. And a few months ago, we had the honor of watching Juan inducted into the New York Journalism Hall of Fame, the first Latino journalist to be inducted there. His speech put the other inductees to shame, like, oh, Charlie Rose and Leslie Stahl. And I just wanted to read a bit of what he said that day. Juan said, I figured my modest contribution would be not writing about outcast neighborhoods, but from them. Not simply to entertain, but to change. Not after the fact, but before it, when coverage could still make a difference. I have tried to use as many of my columns as possible to probe the injustices visited upon the powerless. Yes, the rich and famous are also victims on occasion, but they have so many politicians, lobbyists, lawyers, gossip columnists, and even editorial writers ready to jump to their defense that they'll always do fine without my help. I prefer the desperate unknown reader who comes to me because he or she has gone everywhere else and no one will listen. More often than not, I come across unexpected gems, human beings whose tragedies illuminate the landscape and whose courage hopefully inspires the reader to believe that there is indeed some greater good served by a free press than just chronicling or influencing the ouster of one group of politicians by another. Those are the words of Juan Gonzalez. As I was reading those words in one of these cities that I was in, I was getting texts at that moment of Juan being feted at Francis Tavern, the New York Daily News, through one of the parties. There have been many, many retirement parties for Juan. You know, he's going to be a professor, of journalism at Rutgers. So I'm getting pictures of the party. Juan with Governor Cuomo, Juan with Mayor de Blasio, Juan with Senator Schumer, Juan with Jose Serrano, the congressman, Juan with Geraldo Rivera. And, you know, Cuomo and de Blasio, they couldn't be in the same room at the same time because they hate each other's guts. So that was all coordinated. You know, Cuomo would come in first, take pictures, make a toast, would leave. And I was saying, what is Juan doing with all these politicians? I am absolutely convinced that most of them came to make sure with their own eyes that, in fact, he was retiring because he has dogged them for so long. He may be leaving the Daily News, but he is sticking with his other DN, and that is Democracy Now! Now, I just told you about the Ku Klux Klan blowing up KPFT twice, and that was a story of history, you know, 46 years ago. I cannot believe that we are talking about the Ku Klux Klan today in the 2016 presidential election. How could it be that the presumptive nominee of one of the two major political parties, right, Donald Trump, the Republican presumptive presidential nominee, when asked on CNN by Jake Tapper if he would disavow support of an avowed white supremacist, an avowed Klan leader, David Duke, I can't remember if he was Exalted Cyclops or Grand Dragon, but whether he would disavow support of David Duke and the Klan, he waffled. He said he had to look more deeply into this. When was the last time you heard Donald Trump say he needed to look more deeply into anything? But this, he said, he had to consider, right? What exactly was he weighing? You know, he wanted to find out exactly which Klan chapter was supporting him because he wouldn't want to generalize to all the KKK chapters in the United States. And this is terrifying. You couple that with the violence at his rallies. I mean, he is ripping open the underbelly of hate in America. He is opening a Pandora's box. And I am not saying that presidential candidates are responsible for every act at their rallies if these are huge rallies, as Bernie Sanders has and Donald Trump has some. Bernie Sanders has said no to the violence, that he doesn't condone it. Not only hasn't Trump said that, but he has said he would pay the legal fees of his supporters who get arrested. You know, like this was said after the supporter who sucker punched a Black Lives Matter activist and then said next time he would kill him. The only saving grace here is I think it was Steve Brill, who's the legal reporter and legal publisher, said he found it interesting that Trump was saying he'd pay these supporters' legal bills because he said he never pays his own. But that little side issue there. This is serious. I mean, you know, Democracy Now! Was the closest national broadcast to Ground Zero, September 11, 2001. The horror, 3,000 people incinerated in an instant. We'll never actually know how many people died on that day because those who go uncounted in life go uncounted in death, and they're the undocumented workers and immigrants who might have been around that area. But it was terrifying and horrible. However, it was not the first time that terror came to U.S. shores. Ask any African American about slavery. Ask any Native American about what's happened in this country. But it was horrific. Now, the Ku Klux Klan is a part of this history in the United States, an American homegrown terrorist organization, right? Terrorizing, killing, maiming, lynching thousands of African Americans. We have to know this history. It's not enough just to say the Klan, especially for young people. I think even young people have heard of the Klan, but to tell that history so that it is not repeated. I want to go back to last June, the horror in Charleston. You know what happened in the middle of June 2015 when a young white supremacist, at the time the Bible study group didn't know who he was, a young white man walks into Bible study at Mother Emanuel Church in Charleston. It was a gathering of the parishioners and their beloved pastor, Clemente Pinckney, who also was a state senator in South Carolina. He had rushed from the legislature 2 hours to just be with his flock, his parishioners, midweek evening Bible study, routine. This young white man walks in. They all know each other. They don't know him, but they welcome him. And at the end of the hour, he blows them away. He spares one woman's life, because he wants her to bear witness, to tell the world what he did. A few days later, Dylan Storm Roof would be arraigned. And the survivors and the loved ones of the victims put this country to shame when they forgave him. They forgave him. That put the South Carolina legislature into a difficult position. They had to decide whether to take down the Confederate flag that he wrapped himself in and worshipped, whether to take it down off the Capitol grounds where it had flown for more than half a century. It was a tough decision for them. They put it up in the early 60s in response to the civil rights movement. Then in 2000, the NAACP and some sports franchises said that they would boycott South Carolina. So that led to the South Carolina Compromise. They would take it off the Capitol building and put it on the grounds in front. But there would be heightened penalties against anyone who dared to take it down or deface it, and it could not be unhooked flying at full mast. So a few days later, this now back in June, when State Senator Clemente Pinckney lay in state in the Capitol Rotunda, thousands of people streamed by to pay their respects. First, they had to walk by the Confederate flag, flying proudly outside. All the flags of South Carolina were at half-mast, except for the Confederate flag. That flew at full-mast. We, of course, raced down to Charleston. We broadcast from outside the AME church, and then was the vast funeral of thousands of people who came out to the College of Charleston Arena to pay their respects. That was when President Obama sang Amazing Grace. I think, you know, after that, when the legislature finally decided to take down that flag, if most people were asked who actually took it down, who led the charge, I think most people in this country would say South Carolina Governor Nikki Haley. But that's not who took down the flag. It was 5:30 in the morning on June 27, 2015, 10 days after the massacre at the Emmanuel AME Church. The South Carolina State House glowed in the morning light. Bree Newsom, a 30-year-old African-American woman from Charlotte, North Carolina, walked toward the main entrance of the building. She was accompanied by Jimmy Tyson, a young white man from North Carolina, and others who scouted the grounds. They observed the scene around the State House, waiting until there were no guards visible. After about 30 minutes, Tyson and Newsom made their move. They walked swiftly toward the Confederate monument, which stands directly in front of the main steps. The tall monument, topped with a heroic image of a Confederate soldier, pays tribute to those who have glorified a fallen cause, slavery. The two activists proceeded to the 30-foot-high flagpole that stood directly behind the monument. The Confederate battle flag flapped lazily at the top. Then Bree Newsom donned her climbing gear, which she had learned how to use a few days before. And she raced to the flagpole and began ascending the pole swiftly. Guards noticed and began shouting at her to come down. Reaching the top of the flagpole, she grabbed the Confederate flag and unhooked it. She declared, "You come against me with hatred and oppression and violence. I come against you in the name of God." Bree clutched the symbol of the Confederacy and said, "This flag comes down today." Bree lowered herself slowly along with the flag. As soon as she reached the ground, Newsom and Tyson were arrested. Video of the protests went viral, was seen around the world. Her bail fund quickly raised more than $125,000. Ava DuVernay, director of the Oscar-nominated film Selma, was among the many to hail her, tweeting, "I hope I get the call to direct the motion picture about a black superhero I admire. Her name is Bree Newsom." But within about an hour, two State House workers raised a new Confederate flag on the Capitol grounds. It is astounding to think the mass funeral the day before and that day, this Saturday morning, when Bree took that flag down, the individual funerals were taking place in Charleston. And so as these bodies were being lowered into the ground, the state chose to raise the Confederate flag. Once again, Democracy Now! Raced from Charleston to Columbia. We found out which jail Bree and Jimmy were being held in, and we made it to the jail and actually got into the arraignment cell. And there we watched Bree and Jimmy charged with defacing state property, facing a penalty of up to 3 years in prison and a $5,000 fine. We then went out into the lobby of the jail.